And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
Well, Dean Haglund, unless I'm very much mistaken, you're in Sydney, Australia.
You are not mistaken. I am in Sydney, back in the homestead that is the other homestead that's not Los Angeles.
Down under Dean. You're down under Dean again.
I'm down under Dean. One more time.
Not Dean Hagwood, though you may ask for him by name. And that, of course, is a reference to last week's show, which we will address further on down the road.
Totally.
But it's, I'm back in
Sounds like a sandwich.
Really. the Dean Hagwood. Oh, my goodness.
That is delicious.
Unless I'm mistaken, it's hot buttered tongue.
Wow. You're mistaken.
Or is it like my dad used to say about my mom? My mom. This is one of those really old jokes my dad used to say about my mom's cooking, like her specialty was hot tongue and cold shoulder.
That's funny.
Yeah, I don't know if it is really, but anyway. I'm back in Los Angeles. You're in Australia. Finally, order has come back to Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Finally, we are back to the order that we were always meant to have.
So many miles. We've put on so many miles, you and I, and speaking for me, maybe a few pounds, too. Not going to lie to you. A lot
really?
Of time logged in a car without always the healthiest option or the ability to burn that food off. Boy, it just, the fried foods of the Southwest really sit on you when you're driving.
Particularly, yeah, when you're in the car seat.
But we have some business to finally catch up on. Many August celebrities have left us during the weeks since we've been out traveling, but I feel we would be greatly remiss if we did not celebrate the lives and careers of at least two of them in a little something that we still like to call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
That's what I said, Garrett Watley. Anyway, Dean Haglund first. The day my road trip began, Roger Moore shuffles off the mortal coil.
Oh, yes, of course. The James Bond.
Well, you said the James Bond. He's certainly a James Bond. I think
right.
Certainly if I heard someone say the James Bond, I would think Sean Connery. However,
yes.
Roger Moore is the James Bond I first knew.
Well, exactly. I think we all grew up with that James Bond.
Not all of us. I mean, there could be some older folks listening to this show, Dean.
Yes. When I say us, I meant you and me.
Yes, okay. Yeah, you forget that we have an audience of countless dozens of people enjoying this show. So
clearly, I thought these were our production meetings. I didn't realize.
Oh, you mean we've been putting these online? So
but I didn't know.
Sir Roger Moore. Now, here's just a couple. I didn't. You know, a lot of times I'll look up people. I'll look up things I didn't know about them. Maybe things people didn't know. But Roger Moore is one of those figures where I really feel I can do a good job talking off the top of my head about him and his career. And also because so much time has passed since he died and there have been countless tributes that really it just does boil down to what you and I personally remember about him, I think. But one of the things you might not know, Dean, maybe you do, is he was in the running to be the first British James Bond after that 1950s TV movie where Barry Nelson played Bond in a one-hour Casino Royale broadcast. He was one of the names considered in Dr. No when the role ultimately went to Sean Connery. After after Patrick McGoohan turned the role down, it was, and I think Cary Grant did also, if I'm not mistaken, then Roger Moore was considered, but he was considered too young, a little too pretty. And interestingly enough, they then cast Sean Connery, and yet they were virtually the same age. Roger Moore, in fact, I think might have been 1 year older than Sean Connery, the actor he ultimately would replace.
Now, wasn't he already doing The Saint on British television?
Was he doing The Saint when? Now, see,
he was
this,
offered.
This would have been something I could have researched. I don't know if he was doing The Saint. I doubt he was doing The Saint when Dr. No gets made. He had right around that time. Think about the cojones this guy had, like Timothy Dalton, who would play Bond later on. But Timothy Dalton had to replace Roger Moore. Timothy Dalton did not have to replace Sean Connery. Roger Moore not only replaces Sean Connery as James Bond, but years earlier replaced James Garner in Maverick.
Oh, how far back does that go?
So that's got to be early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, because as your television student of television history as you are, you might remember that James Garner did the unthinkable and broke his television contract. He was the David Caruso of his age, though talented enough and handsome enough that he actually did get to go do movies, unlike David Caruso, where it all fell apart. And I know what most of you at home are asking. You're thinking, who's David Caruso? And that's exactly my point. So anyway, he replaces James Garner for a brief period of time because Maverick doesn't really fly without James Garner. He, of course, achieves international stardom as Simon Templar in The Saint. And there is a whole generation of people, actually, who never could accept Roger Moore as James Bond. And yes, part of that had to do with him not being Sean Connery. But I also think, in fairness to him, a lot of it had to do with them not being able to stop seeing Simon Templar the Saint when they saw Roger Moore.
Right.
Because he was so good in that role.
Absolutely. Suave. I mean, The Saint required a much more sly sense of humor and a joie de vivre that James Bond maybe didn't have to have. You know, Sean Connery always put such a panther-like move, and there was a sinister underline to the Sean Connery James Bonds. But when Roger Moore came in, it was much lighter and more comedic, actually.
They tried to put, they tried to take advantage of what he could bring. I would be remiss if I didn't say that right before taking over to play James Bond in Live and Let Die, he did a short-lived and quite excellent British-American co-production TV series called The Persuaders with Tony Curtis. And it is fun. If you ever get a chance to check those discs out, please do. I think there's maybe 17, 18 episodes of it. And it would have gone on longer, but the James Bond schedule stepped in. At their best, often, I'm thinking probably Spy Who Loved Me, they managed to give Roger Moore some light romantic comedy scenes to play that really take advantage of his skill set. I recall once I discovered the Sean Connery Bonds that I would inherently start to characterize Roger Moore as being more of a lightweight actor than Sean Connery because of what you were describing. And yet now I go back to them and I realize, no, you know, he's very much in on the joke. So if the films didn't work, if they didn't have the right tone, if they were too lightweight, it wasn't his fault. There were a lot of things going in trying to craft them and trying to perfect the tone. And I will also point out, look, he did a handful of great James Bond films. I'm particularly fond of For Your Eyes Only. Spy Who Loved Me is excellent. Though I do, again, it isn't until For Your Eyes Only that I stopped seeing Simon Templar. That's when it really happens. Maybe it's Moonraker. Moonraker where I start to see it, but only because Simon Templar in The Saint was never as bad as Moonraker.
Right. Moonraker I had a lot of trouble with.
Although, here's a moment. There is a great moment in Moonraker that's courtesy of Roger Moore and kind of makes you wonder where they might have gone with him as Bond if they didn't feel the need to always play to his comedic strengths. There's one moment in Moonraker where he gets trapped on a centrifugal force, a testing machine at NASA, and he almost dies in it. And when he escapes and gets out from it, there is no one-liner, punchline, or gag about it. They let Roger Moore play injured, play scared, play shaken. And it's a powerful moment in an otherwise fairly abysmal joke of a movie.
Right. Well, I think they realized somewhere along the way that, you know, you can't just do one-liners after everything. You have to build the stakes up to have actual threat to James Bond in order to maintain interest and drama, as it were. So,
one of the movies that I think it ended up doing very well, but people really were not looking forward to it when it came out. And in retrospect, people remember it, I think, for what they feared and not for what it actually was, because I read bad reviews of this movie that doesn't actually apply to what the movie is. And that's Octopussy. First, you've got a terrible title. You had all the ad campaign about him dressed as a clown, and it played into your worst fears of a Roger Moore James Bond movie. But instead, what it was an actually fairly crackling and sophisticated Cold War thriller.
Yeah. Again, I only saw that originally. I don't think I've actually re-seen it in a... in a recent viewing, so I remember it being better than it was, for sure. Because your fear of, oh my God, Octopussy, what a horrible name.
Yeah, and you know, him dressed as a clown, and it's going to be wacky. Look, there's a couple of moments in it. There's a Tarzan yell. There's the cut to an animal having a reaction shot, which they love to do in the Roger Moore Bond movies. But, like I said, for the most part, a really, really tense and fun Cold War thriller, and one that allowed him to really play the age he was and to play opposite actors the same age, both men and women. And it's, like I said, it's sophisticated, rarely applies to a Bond film. It certainly rarely applies to a Roger Moore Bond film, but I think it applies to that one. So maybe you can check it out.
This seems to be the beginning of a disconnect between marketing and product. If we were to walk it backwards to when marketing had to be ahead of the movie being completed, it seems right around here that scenario, that trend started.
Yeah, and they end up releasing what they have, and it's a mistake. Yeah. Like I said, it ended up doing very well, but I think that was also... thank God that was at an era where a movie couldn't get killed by the advanced publicity. Whereas now the internet can obviously kill a movie. It can be dead on arrival. Are there any other Roger Moore performances in movies, perhaps, that you remember, Dean?
Let me think now. There was... oh my God, do I have to go to the internet on this one? There was a TV series where he sang in a musical. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
I did hear a single that he had from 1964, a spoken word single. That's how I found out that he died. I was wondering, what the hell is this on the 60s on 6 on Sirius XM? It's a weird spoken word thing by Roger Moore. And then my heart sank, realizing, oh, that can only mean one thing.
Right, right.
Why would we dig that out? But
I think, oh, my God. I'm having a memory of him singing in like a musical, sort of a Camelot type thing. And I will now stop talking because
you're going to look it up.
Remember it.
You're going to look it up.
Yeah.
People will hopefully write into us about it. I think it is particularly unfair that Roger Moore was criticized when he was playing Bond for not being able to shake Simon Templar. And yet, when he would do non-Bond films, critics would criticize them, saying, well, Roger Moore can't shake the James Bond image. An image you say he doesn't have in the Bond movies.
I know, right?
But there were some really fun 1970s productions that he was in, like The Sea Wolves, like Folks, where he plays a cat-loving admiral who's a specialist in anti-terrorism, has a fantastic beard in it, and of course the Wild Geese. So these are really fun movies. He's really good in them. And then there's an independent film from Golan and Globus from Canon Films back in the 80s, and I tried to rewatch it, and it's not good. It's not good, but he plays a psychiatrist who's suspected of murdering one of his own patients. And it's called The Naked Face, and God bless Roger Moore. He wants this to be good. And he's interesting. He's giving a good performance in it. You know who else is giving a really good performance? Is Elliot Gould as one of the police officers investigating him. Meanwhile, the guy playing Elliot Gould's partner, who, as he often did in the 1980s, was just picking up a paycheck, knowing that what he was doing was terrible, so he had no moral compunction against chewing and spitting out every bit of scenery. That was Rod Steiger. But you got the three of these guys in a... I think a young Ann Archer is in it also. So it's fun to see... especially for the work that Roger Moore is doing, though I won't go so far as to claim that it's a good movie. Though when it came out and I was, you know, a teenager, I thought it was wicked cool.
Well, see, there you go. So
now from James Bond, who sometimes had it difficult to be taken seriously, to an actor who, boy, he couldn't get arrested at times because no one could take him seriously, which always seemed to me to be wildly unfair because of how gifted this man was. I don't know if you'll agree with me about that assessment, but Adam West.
Oh yeah.
Are you?
Well, you think
you seem hesitant. You don't think Adam West was a talent.
Gosh, I mean, certainly funny as the mayor of Quahog in Family Guy. You realized he had much more in on the joke because you didn't know if he knew Batman was funny or not. You know, that camp value, it's hard to determine watching the 60s Batman TV series to know that if he knew the tone the show was doing. You know what I'm saying?
I feel like maybe this is because, you know, I'm 12 years old when Airplane comes out. But
right?
But to me, there's no Airplane without Batman, actually, you know? And so I see these actors in Airplane and I go, oh, Adam West was in on the joke. Adam West understood. And what's brilliant about it, And I think you'd at least agree with me that if he was in on the joke, if he did understand the camp tone, then he's brilliant because he never lets on once. He never asks for the joke, the laughs.
Right.
He never is winking at all. There is a moment in the Batman movie where he's desperately trying to dispose of a bomb, the most ridiculous Acme bomb out of Wile E. Coyote's imagination. And
absolutely,
and he's trying to dispose of it, and there's something blocking his path. First there's nuns, then there's a marching band, then there's a school field trip, and then there's a little school of ducks, and finally he just pauses and he says, some days you just can't get rid of a bomb. And and there's no asking for the laughs at all, and it's one of my favorite moments in any movie as a result.
It's true, because you really have to stay focused and play it for real. And he was doing that throughout.
But you're not sure. But you're not sure that he didn't think that it was actually serious.
Yeah, it's tough, you know, only because of stories that I heard of him on the road at the sci-fi convention circuit made me think that there was some unresolved emotional issues involved with him portraying that Batman. But again, having no personal contact, we never sat down and chatted about it. There's, I think, only two conventions where we were both, and I think they were Dragon Con. So they were too massive for us to actually hang out backstage. So I am just basing that on what other I've heard from other organizers and fans.
Well, he was obviously, as stories tell, at least a bit bitter, as one could understand. I mean, to a degree, what the what the Star Trek actors felt, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a job
because it's
pre-residuals. Yeah, their residuals were used up fast. And remember, God, Batman only lasted a few years, but it was hundreds of episodes because at its peak, it was on two nights a week with new episodes, and they were both in the top 10.
Yeah. So to churn that out, I mean, you probably only had one take at a go or to run that.
And no, like you're saying, no residuals. It's a job, and you're glad to have the job, but it's not all you can do. You could understand some resentment developing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think that sort of spilt over into at least his public appearances.
That's sad to hear. But now you mentioned some of his voice work. You know, there were occasional performances where he would use his reputation, both his reputation as Batman and that kind of acting, but also his reputation as maybe being difficult or abrasive, or not. That's not quite the right word. Maybe self-involved is a better word.
Right.
Self-important. Like, you know, I mean, that's kind of the stories that that I kind of heard. And again, you could understand it, because if nobody else took him seriously, he was going to respond by taking himself maybe a little too seriously. But a couple of movies that he was in, that one of which was a really big hit, and that is Hooper, the movie where when Burt Reynolds was the biggest movie star on the planet and he played a stuntman. And the actor who played the lead actor in the movie within the movie, i.e. the actor that Burt Reynolds Hooper would be doubling on all these stunts, that was Adam West.
Right.
And it is a wickedly funny turn, satirizing the movie star mentality.
Which he had to know then that that was his, you know, in his wheelhouse to do. So I think there's a lot of times, particularly in the 70s and the 80s, that he embodied the atypical self-important and portrayed it. So was it life mimicking art or art mimicking life?
We will never know. We will never know, Dean Hagelin.
We'll never know. Damn it.
Another movie that I really think he helps breathe life into, Michael Tolkien, who is most famous for writing The Player, Robert Altman's The Player, directed in 1994 a comedy drama called The New Age, which was a look at kind of a dysfunctional marital relationship, married couple played by Peter Weller and the great Judy Davis. And Adam West plays Peter Weller's dad in the movie. And kind of, for me, walks away with the film.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, now this I have to see. I don't think I've seen it. The New Age.
Yeah, The New Age. It was an underrated film. And from what I heard by that point, he was really a particularly very sweet man to be around and to work with. Yeah. Had probably gotten over whatever resentment he had had. Well, are there other, you mentioned Family Guy, are there other notable voice roles that he played? I always associate him in later years with his voice work.
Yeah. Well, he did, he was in the Batman versus Two-Face that's coming out soon. Like, so he was doing voice work right up until the end, in the animated stuff. Including, I didn't know this, but he did a Scooby-Doo episode, 2015.
Wow.
So he was, I know. So he was active still as a voiceover actor, probably because also his rise in Family Guy. Everybody heard that, that his voice quality was fantastic and had that... sardonic, I think, is the key word. Sardonic tone all the way through it.
Here is kind of the holy grail for me of what I want to track down, not only because of the career of Adam West, but also because of my abiding love for William Shatner. The two of them did a pilot together.
Yeah.
Pre-Batman, pre-Star Trek. Alexander the Great, both of them in togas with pageboy haircuts, and it was a 30-minute pilot, which leads me to believe that it was a sitcom about Alexander the Great.
Wow. Who pitched that?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Amazing.
And how can I become their best friend? Because that kind of madness, I don't even know what to... I mean... Mel Brooks had not come along at that point,
So
anyway, I've got to track that down. That's a holy grail for me. A letter from a listener, Dean Hagland.
Hooray, our favorite.
This letter comes to us about last week's show from none other than Dean Hagland.
What? It's me. I wrote us a letter.
The letter said, just listen to you and Lil. Happy belated.
Yes.
I didn't know which on stream to hit with that message. I don't know what that means, but anyway.
That should be online stream.
I see.
She's on Facebook. She's on Instagram. Oh.
Where isn't
she? Happy birthday.
Where isn't
she? Where do you say that?
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
It's her birthday month, so it's not belated. Don't worry about it.
Oh, fantastic.
In fact, as we talked about, I think we talked about on the show, the Catoosa blue whale, she has decided that's what she wants for her birthday, is that actual whale. Anyway,
wow.
But the reason I bring up your letter is you wrote, that lightning sounded fake. Did you add it afterwards?
Totally.
That's something, that should be a thing we do, is what you,
totally.
Is what you wrote. No, that lightning... and thunder that you hear in last week's show, people should check it out for no other reason than there is a blast at one point that literally had me hitting the floor. It was so loud.
It's sort of unbelievably loud. It's so Hollywood sounding. Like, it was a perfect, it wasn't a slow rumble. It was a crack with a fade off that was like, oh, wait a sec. That sounds totally from the the library of fake sound effects, 1964.
Well, now
edition.
Now maybe we'll use it. Maybe I'll go and clip it out, and we will use it for that purpose. But no, it's like you remember we've talked about this, I think, but the famous Scream story about Karen Allen in Raiders of the Lost Ark. She has to spend most of the movie screaming, and yet she was totally unable to realistically scream because she's not a woman that
right.
gets easily frightened. That's not her thing. And so one time they're in the Well of the Souls with the snakes, and she remembers seeing Spielberg walking around on the what do you call those? The catwalks.
And
while they're filming, and she's wondering, what is he doing up there? But then she gets immersed in the scene, and they're rolling, and she's climbing something, and all of a sudden, he drops a gigantic snake onto her neck and head. And she lets out a blood-curdling scream. And when you watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, every time she screams in that movie, it is that scream being altered in some way.
Some version of it.
Yeah, some version of it, but it's one scream that's used throughout. So we'll use the one real lightning thunder blast in phony ways in the future. But no, it was real, and I bring it up because we truly were lightning rods on this trip. when we were arriving in Rosedale, Mississippi, the Delta, for a weekend to attend a wedding, a place that I love, as you know, the last time we were there, the first time I'd ever visited, and I went, okay, this, we're getting near, many places claim to be home of the crossroads where Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil. But when we were hitting the one entering Rosedale and wind suddenly whipped up out of nowhere, so strong that the freeway signs themselves were spinning around in pirouetting 360s.
Wow.
That was what made me say, no, you know, now we're getting near where Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil. This is quite the sign marker. And this trip, as soon as we hit that same stretch of road, suddenly the skies open and we've been watching lightning from a distance striking right on either side of the road as we approached. But now that we get there, the skies open, thunder comes in, and then as soon as the thunder comes in, a downpour, the likes of which I have not had to drive through in probably 30 years. And how severe was it? Well, on this two-lane road, when a big rig truck would drive in the other lane, I got a forearm workout holding that wheel steady so that we were not blown off into the levee.
Good Lord.
And our GPS was telling us, flash flood warning, do not drive on this road.
Oh, my God.
So nothing.
Why didn't you pull over? Why didn't
there was nowhere to pull over. There was nowhere to pull over because it was flooding to either side. I mean, and nothing welcomes you to a place than a message that says, get off the road. Don't come here. So we arrive at Beulah Island hunting. It's a hunting club, Beulah Island Hunting Club, which is in the Mississippi River. You go through Rosedale, past the levees, but the island itself, although connected by a bridge into Mississippi, anything in the river is actually Arkansas. So you go across this little tiny bridge that up until a week prior had been underwater. And you hear the welcome to Arkansas on your GPS. But we get there and I back up to the staircase. I tell Lily, just go inside. We only have a few minutes to get ready for this rehearsal dinner party that we have to drive to. So I tell her to go up the stairs, get inside, stay dry, and I'll bring all the luggage up. I only have to bring it up a flight of about, 10, 12 steps. But I get really quite drenched doing so. No sooner do I get the final suitcase inside, it stops. The rain just stops, and it does not return for the rest of our stay there. So it was literally just welcoming us to Rosedale. We then, after being in Rosedale, go to Hot Springs, Arkansas, which is famous for what I have learned has been called the Golden Age of Bathing. Apparently, there was a Golden Age of Bathing. Also famous for being the birthplace of one president named William Jefferson Clinton, but long before that, the home of such august personalities as Al Capone. It has a big gangster and gambling history even before that. Clinton's born in the home of Al Capone. Interesting. Nobody's doing any conspiracy theories about that. Anyway, so we go there, and again, trapped in just a lightning and thunderstorm so strong that I couldn't sleep through it. I mean, I sleep through anything, and it was as if somebody was setting off TNT right outside the window.
Good Lord.
And the wind, and then the rain that followed was so hard that it really, and it was kind of sideways because of the wind, it really sounded like it was going to break through the glass on the windows.
Good Lord.
And no, it did not. As far as I know, though there was so much renovation and construction being done on this historic hotel that I don't know if I would have noticed, honestly. And then we go to Tucumcari, New Mexico, and you hear the storm that surprises everyone. No, we never get rain this time of year. No, it's in the distance. No, we can't. It can't possibly happen. It can if Lil and Phil are there. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
And
you're the rainmakers,
and you heard that. And then the final little expression of this, of us being lightning rods, we went to Bandelier National Monument, which is outside White Rock, New Mexico, about an hour drive from the state capital of Santa Fe. And it is an extraordinary place. A lot of remains and ruins of the Pueblo cultures that go back thousands of years. Pueblos, cliff dwellings, everything you could possibly want to explore, though not necessarily would you want to explore these cave dwellings because you were climbing up into them to get out of the sudden and unexpected lightning and thunder and downpour. But that's what I did.
Good
like
Lord.
The ancient people, I spent a half hour waiting out a storm inside this cave, much like the early peoples.
Early. Good Lord. And I would think animals are doing the same thing. Were you not scared?
There were animals. I got a nice face-to-face chat with a full-horned buck. With a male deer. I learned they were called bucks because I like to learn about science and nature. there were a lot of animals that we saw. Sadly, when you're driving across America, most of your the animals you encounter are roadkill and quite a array of it. But no, we would have little fawns racing the car because, as you know, we eschew the highways as much as possible. We take the two-lane back roads, and so you'll see occasionally crocodiles, you'll see snakes, you'll see wild cats and dogs and jackrabbit. I actually saw my first jackrabbit, believe it or not. But I did not see that from the cave in Bandelier National Monument. A thing that happened, though, that I think you will find interesting that is non-meteorological in nature. On the way to Bandelier, we pass around Los Alamos National Laboratory. And this, for people who don't know, is where the Manhattan Project successfully built, what was it, Fat Man and Little Boy, right?
Exactly, the two first atomic weapons.
And even prior to that, where they built the one that was tested successfully down further south in the state at Alamogordo. So it
is... White Sands.
In White Sands, yes. So it is... Yeah. It's quite the big deal to this day. If you go to their website, it's shocking how peppy the website is and how great they feel about putting science towards the use of defending America from its threats militarily. It's a real rah-rah site about how science is best used to create weaponry, basically. And there is certainly an argument to be made for that. What struck me as odd, Dean, was that it never bothered anybody to the point that they would think, let's build elsewhere, to consider that right next door, while they're building a weapon that could lead to the destruction of all of our culture, is all these remains of a culture that was wiped out.
Oh.
Like, you would think when you looked out the window and saw this, guys, maybe we need to look into developing a sense of irony about what we're doing.
That's right.
Anyway.
Oh, my God.
I wanted to get some footage of the White Rock training facility, because there's some good signage there, good gates and stuff, might make good footage for use in some movie, right? So when I know that it's nearby, I program in an additional stop before Bandelier National Monument. I program in Los Alamos White Rock Training Facility. And for the first time ever, my GPS takes me to the wrong place while telling me that I'm at the right place. And what it took me to was a fast food drive-through at a neighboring town. And it said, you have now arrived at a White Rock training facility. Now, granted, they were experimenting with a lot of chemicals, no doubt, at this fast food drive-through. But they were not a research laboratory commissioned for the defense of this country. So that's odd to me, but I figure, oh, well. And we just, as case would have it, we just end up passing it anyway, and I get the footage that I need. But at no point thereafter does my navigation app work anymore. And not only that, but I quickly realize I have no internet access either on my phone, even though I have full bars. So I figure, well, why don't I let it just sit, and then I'll try it again later. And after we explore the National Monument, I try to start up. I promised myself I wouldn't cry, but I tried to start up my navigation app again. And suddenly my phone automatically started to reboot. And it then stopped and froze halfway through the boot process. And then continued to reboot and freeze halfway through the process. This has never happened. Never had a problem rebooting the phone. And, of course, I hadn't tried to reboot the phone in the first damn place. So I kept trying to turn it off now. Can't turn it off. It keeps rebooting and stopping halfway through the process. And it isn't until we are off the national park land, we are off the National Laboratory land, and we are off the Indian Reservation land, and finally onto what I think we could call public roads, that suddenly my phone snaps back to life and everything's working again.
What? How mysterious.
Is it mysterious, or do we just automatically know that I had apparently programmed in a search site that raised some bells and whistles, and so my phone got co-opted?
Yeah. Well, you know, they say that technology exists, but are they applying it to each and every one of us?
Well, if we're nearby and we're looking for, they may have been searching my phone for stuff, right?
That could very well be. Yeah.
I mean, I can't believe that the only time I have that happen is when I'm trying to figure out how to get some sneaky footage of a national laboratory. I mean, it seems, the other thing, Dean, is since that point, I've had a warning come up on my phone, says, wanting me to click a complete uninstall Motorola sensor services firmware. This will revert firmware to a previous version. Your phone will restart after you click uninstall. So something is supposed to be wiped out and reverted to a previous form. I mean, I don't know. Coincidence could be, I guess, maybe I've just been with you too long. Obviously, I've been killing technology left, right, and center since this trip began. But it's still a little bit spooky.
That is spooky. And, you know, security comes at the cost of liberty.
I guess. Spoken like a true American who's left the country. Now, how were your travels after I parted ways with you in Dallas?
Well, they were certainly adventurous. Let's see. I added an extra 17,000 miles of journeying from then on in, didn't I?
I don't know.
Dallas back to L.A., L.A. up to Canada, Canada down to L.A. again, up to San Francisco, and then back across the ocean.
Wow.
I know. I'm glad to report the airports are all still there and operational. That's nice. Food quality's improved on some of the flights than I remembered. And there were no, you know, I was so worried about reading all these stories of fights breaking out, flights grounded because of bad behavior on passengers, people putting their bare stinky feet up on in between the seats now. But I didn't experience any of that. Everyone seemed to be civil and decor. I don't know what flights are going on where people have lost their social norms. What do we call those? Social mores?
I don't know. Just civility. Decorum? Civility. I mean, civility. This is what came up a lot during my trip is just, you know, this idea that you know, we have to be able to at least level criticisms where it comes to manners, decency, civility, and those should not be politicized, right?
Right.
Manners and civility are just like morality or ethics. These are not political issues. These are right. human They're... issues.
Right. And so I'm glad I didn't have to experience any of them up front, but it certainly was on the top of my mind every flight I got onto. Not the Canadian ones, mind you. There still seems to be a civility going on up there. But all the stories that I read here in Australia always portray America flight behavior gone crazy.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Now, did you, when you were in L.A., did you lock down the details of your proposed forthcoming art show?
It's now official. Announced it on my Instagram account, July 13th. Why not come to the Fine Arts Gallery in downtown Los Angeles for the opening of my Broadway tour art exhibition, Watercolors of Historic Buildings and Signage of Downtown Los Angeles. 17 pieces in all, plus my book, which is a compendium of those pieces in tour form, will also be for sale and signed in the gallery on the 13th of July during Art Walk.
So during Art Walk.
Between,
okay.
Yeah. Between 4 and 7 or 6 and 10. I forget how it goes.
We'll figure out the hours before then, but everybody should pay attention to that Thursday, July 13th, big deal, Art Walk. So much fun. Lots of people participate. And what a fun way to open your gallery show, which will run how long?
Right up until August 8th. So it's a month-long show. And all the pieces are for sale except one, which has already been purchased. So,
Although you'll be there on opening night on July 13th, you will be in town for a few days thereafter. So isn't it possible that if somebody comes by and wants to buy a painting or whatever, they can meet the artist?
They certainly can. That can happen all week long or even a week and a half. 10 days, I think I'll be there afterwards. So... So I insist.
I know that you'll be coming and visiting the Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the 19th, and of course I'll be doing a big spiel about your show at the Breakfast Club on the 12th.
Hooray!
But I'm wondering if maybe if we arranged a little Breakfast Club outing, if the artist would be available on another night, on a less packed night rather than Art Walk, might be available either night or afternoon or something to talk about his works.
I like it. A special presentation, as it were. Artist presentations, they call them. on any night that you can organize a breakfast club to come on by. That'd be fun.
Well, we'll look into that. That will be that'll be great fun. What else do I need to ask you? When you're here, we should probably do what we promised, which was go back to the cemetery, go back to Forest Lawn, and check out the Hall of the Resurrection or whatever that was that we didn't get to see when it was closed.
Absolutely. You know who will be here also till the 17th is John K. Steele, the tour guide, the Jack the Ripper tour guide and good friend of the show.
He will. No one will love the world's largest painting of the Crucifixion and Resurrection like John K. Steele. No one.
That's true, right? So let's plan it for that weekend, perhaps, just before the 17th.
That was a production meeting on the air. Now,
there you go.
Let's do a little something we call Live Event of the Week, because I've got two, one of which is going to blow your mind.
Oh.
The Chilpac Hollywood Live Event of the Week.
As part of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, Dean, today I went to the Museum of Neon Art in Glendale, California, saw a wonderful exhibit on plasma art, and got to visit the classrooms where they teach how to make neon art. And the whole tour was conducted by Eric Linksweiler, the man who literally wrote the book on neon art. And the whole tour was a fundraiser for the Breakfast Club, because the Breakfast Club has been a friend to the Museum of Neon Art, and they were returning the favor. But I'm fascinated. A lot of people just think of neon and think of the signage, think of it as advertising. But, of course, it went the way of the dodo in terms of advertising many, many, many decades ago. So it's really artists that have kept neon alive. And anyway, one of the things, and I don't know if you will know this, but I'm going to hit you with a trivia question. Because the question was, how long can these tubes burn? And the answer was, forever, if they were well made, if they're truly pure and vacuum packed. Because the gas will remain inside them forever.
Clifton's Cafeteria.
Oh, you knew. You knew this was going to be my question. Okay, please tell the story. Tell the story.
When they renovated Clifton's Cafeteria, they removed a wall paneling, and there, still burning, was original building. They assume 1932 when it was installed, and had been burning continually for 80 years,
because it was this decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was this decade. So
longest continuing burn of a neon tube in history.
Yeah. It's down in the basement. If you go, you can see it below by the women's bathroom, I believe. But it at one time had, it was backlighting signage for some of the specials, I believe, that was down there. And somebody just put the panel over it, and then when they removed it and saw it still burning, they immediately sealed it in plexiglass so none of the workers would kick it, and that this became one of the great historical highlights of the Clifton renovation.
That I'm going to have to go back down and check. Maybe Art Walk. Maybe I'll go down Art Walk.
Well, yeah. We'll take, again, John K. Steele. No one else would appreciate that more. That and the cemetery than John K. Steele.
That's very, very cool. Hey, the other live event of the week that I wanted to talk about, and unfortunately... I have my information here now. I saw in New York on Broadway, just scant days before it won the Tony for Best Play, I saw Oslo, a 3-hour plus dramatization of the Oslo Accord talks between Palestine and Israel.
Israel and Palestine in 1991?
And It's maybe the best. We did a show of our top 10 live events of all time, and this may very well be the best play I've ever seen.
What?
You know I love ensembles, big ensembles. It's a huge ensemble cast, and even with that, many people have to play multiple characters. And but Dean, it's a whole show that's about listening. And it's the hardest thing for me to get my actors to do in acting class is look, it all comes down to no matter how much time you've had to prep or not prep, no matter, you know, what else is going on, if you can listen and be affected by things, that's acting. And and it's a whole show that's about listening. You have, as your two leads, Jefferson Mays, who plays the Norwegian man at the think tank university, who first came up with the idea of, you know, having these back channel communications. And Jefferson Mays is just a delightful performer. And opposite him, playing his wife, who is a low-level government official, is Jennifer Ely. Has been called, you know, the finest actress of her generation. Two-time Tony winner already. She was nominated for Best Actress this year, didn't win. Laurie Metcalf won it because there's this kind of unwritten rule that you don't get to win three Tonys. But they, but they're your leads, and yet for long periods of time, they are just on stage listening. And yet it's this fantastic show where no matter how many times you go, look, a live show is always different. That's one of the things we love about it. But here's a play where you could go multiple times and never remotely have the same experience because you can track entirely different sets of characters on stage. It was at Lincoln Center is where it's playing. And like I said, it won the Tony for Best Play. Oslo, three-plus hours.
You're sitting in a chair. It's not like Faith No More or
but the proscenium is such that it's almost in the round, and you know the beauty of a play is that it's democratic versus most film, which is fascist, because we filmmakers direct your attention. And here,
you point the camera at a thing.
And here you get to choose what you want to watch. Unfortunately, most plays are directed for the benefit of the people who are speaking.
You liked this guy talking.
That is not, and you block it that way. But in a theater that is almost in the round, well, there is no such thing as doing that. And the audience is very much left to their own devices in terms of who do we follow. Because after all, there's long periods of time where the people who are speaking have their back to you. And that's the point.
You're kidding.
And that's the point. No, how could that not be? They're looking directly at some of the other audience. But so anyway, it's the perfect setting for just a spectacular play. And I had the option of seeing that or seeing A Doll's House Part 2, which is directed by Sam Gold, who we've talked about on this show
a lot,
and for which Laurie Metcalf won her Tony. And that's supposed to be fantastic, 90 minutes long. And, of course, I chose the three-hour-plus film about play about Norway. But I reasoned that there will be lots of other productions of A Doll's House Part 2. Sam Gold might even come to Los Angeles to direct them, as he has done in the past. And I'm sure I'll get to see very good productions. But something told me, as with August Osage County, which was on my list of 10 favorite live events, that if I didn't see this original Broadway production of Oslo, I might never really see it. So that's why
And what is subject matter? You would think an Oslo peace accord. I mean, the peace accord negotiation is not riveting theater, but now you say this, this sounds fascinating.
It is riveting. Some of the supporting players are just extraordinary, especially one young man who I'm not even going to guess which, you know, who it was. But he won a Tony for Best Supporting Actor, basically, playing one of the Israeli diplomats. Just extraordinary. But it is not only riveting drama and very funny and really in provides great insight into Norwegian culture, which I appreciated. But boy, it's relevant and resonant and emotionally rich, especially given the lack of listening and civility that's going on in this country right now.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Fantastic. Not a dry eye in the house at the end of it.
You're kidding.
So that brings us to the end, really, of our first, what we would call maybe a normal hour of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour in some time.
We're back, everyone.
We didn't get around to talking about any movies. I imagine you saw a handful on some of your flights.
I did see a handful. Does any stand out spectacularly? Nothing that can't wait till next week.
Excellent. So we will talk about many movies that didn't stand out on next week's show. We might even talk about a couple of the biggies, like the latest in the Alien franchise, and a little something that the kids seem to be into called Wonder Woman. But until next week,
yes,
I'm your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness.
And I'm Dean Haglund, down under.
You can find every episode of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. You can download them, stream them, even subscribe via iTunes.
Write a review if you don't mind.
What could
be? Find us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram by going at Dean and Phil. Wear it out the word and.
We promise we'll start posting some new photos again and some delightful hashtags.
That'll be fun. I would love that.
Please write us as Dean Haglund did. At chillpackhollywood @yahoo.com. That's chillpackhollywood @yahoo.com. We like talking about what you want us to talk about, provided we have something to say and we find the topic interesting. It's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. Until next week.
Cue thunder right there.
We'll try to get that loaded for next week. Until then, be decent and civil, everybody, especially on flights, and keep your shoes on, won't you?
Won't you? Excellent. Till then, I'm Dean Haglund.
See ya.
Belated spoiler alert.